Hello, everyone, and welcome to In Defense of Liberation, the show that is working towards and educating about true people's liberation movements and revolution. I am your host, Josh. I use she, her pronouns, and I'd like to say thank you and welcome to the show. We will be expanding on our past two episodes in this series. This series being on introductions to pretty common questions, more controversial topics, and more complicated issues, which oftentimes are present or becoming more prevalent in the spaces which I would assume many of us who are thinking about, acting upon, or getting involved in these types of activities. We have recently seen that ultimately what has become a much, much more strong tendency, but has always had a certain dominance within Western culture and colonized cultures from the West, is this lack of understanding and awareness due to a poorly constructed form of study and knowledge building from very early on in our education and socialization, as well as a general imperialist analysis and imperialist lens on the world events happening around us, which we get when we listen to the speeches, the news headlines, or the online talking heads and social media bots about certain issues, like, for example, NATO's war of encirclement against Russia, when we talk about China, when we talk about socialism. All of these things are purposely skewed in the minds of the masses of people. And not only are these ideas skewed, but how ideas actually form and how we gauge ideas versus material reality and test our theories, as well as study, all are obfuscated and mystified so as to create a populace which has a serious difficulty not only in becoming educated, but also in attempting to educate itself. So because of this, I wanted to start this series, as well as because of a suggestion from a comrade who reached out and expressed an interest in having more short form clips, not only for the sake of, like, you know, I feel personally they're more shareable, they're a bit more condensed, which has, you know, both of these things have positive and negative sides to them. But lastly, also, you know, for the sake of easy listening, and then hopefully encouraging others to go learn about these things themselves, or to reach out and to connect with either myself or other organizations in their local area, or national groups or international groups, to learn about the different complex issues we are facing as a global populace from those who have experience waging a struggle against it. So now, if we want to be able to do that, then we have to know that this takes a certain kind of patience, a certain type of relationality with others, and also a certain type of honesty with ourselves about what we do and don't actually know. this is something that I personally struggle with, even still to this day, because I've always had it with myself that I tend to be more studious than a lot of, for example, early on my family members. I'm the first in my immediate family to go to college and graduate, which isn't like to say anything about the rest of my family or people who don't go to school, but it's just to say that that was more my cup of tea, shall we say. I like reading books. I like knowledge. Like, I like learning about anything and everything that I can. And I have to say that when I was first learning about Marxism and socialism, understanding capitalism and imperialism, learning the history of colonialism, it was like a drug, because there's so much new information to learn because we are so entrenched in misinformation and mistactics on how to actually inform and educate ourselves. So, anyways, in the last two episodes, we have talked first and foremost about capitalist exploitation. How does it happen? Where does it happen? Why does it happen? How often does it happen? Etc. Then today, I actually posted an episode earlier this morning going over the general characteristics of imperialism. And I wanted to expand on both of these ideas by talking about something that a lot of us don't have a great grasp on because it's difficult to understand, myself included, but also because one of the main places to learn about what I want to talk about today, commodity production under capitalism, tends to be in economics books or from the one place that very few of us want to meander, which is into Das Kapital, or Capital, by Karl Marx. Now, I'm very lucky to have some great comrades who also enjoy studying, who also enjoy reading, who have decided that they would like to do a small study group to go over Volume 1 of Capital by Karl Marx. So it's actually been interesting because I definitely felt early on, we've been going at it for about, I'd say, 6 months now, and we're finishing up chapter 3. We're taking it extremely slow, and we've actually gone back twice to re-review chapters 1 and 2 after a brief period of kind of not meeting. Anyways, so this is important, I think, because when society started to, you know, really concretize itself, historically speaking, it was first and foremost in a communalistic way. Oh, look at this jackass. It was first in a communalistic way and a cooperative way for the sake of survival, meaning that groups of people, civilizations, whatever you want to call them, they ultimately had to form somewhat cohesive bonds, not only in production and in social development, but also in distribution and consumption and other responsibilities that may exist within society, such as caretaking, such as healthcare and reproduction, etc. This, of course, happened because in the period of time which humans were starting to evolve into a species that was social, that required, due to our own physical characteristics, a collective for the sake of defense. Because no matter what species of human being you're talking about, because of course we know there is more than just the Homo sapiens who came around, but, you know, we didn't have massive claws or extremely gigantic muscles or fur to cover our body, stuff like that, right? We were not, as other animals were, as adapted for, say, taking on a fucking bear, right? Or, like, dealing with sub-zero temperatures for an extended period of time. So, for the sake of survival, one would expect that then folks had to band together to find a way in which to make sure that the majority could survive. Because if the majority could survive, then again, you know, because it's a collective society, then once again, when the next crisis or emergency or difficulties arise, there is a majority, a collective, a somewhat cooperative society that can approach these problems. And this also meant that different members within society played different roles. Early on, one of the first divisions into what we call class society, which is when one group, oftentimes and almost always, the minority, the small group within society, extremely small group in many cases, owns above and beyond the majority of society what we call the means of production, which is anything that is used to produce the things that the society consumes. So this could be resources, this could be labor forces, this could be tools, this could be factories, this could be shipping companies, it could be banks and credit unions. And also, class society is a period in which one group of society, again the minority, rules over the other through force. Whether that be force of arms, whether that be the force of law, whether that be the force of religious extremism, or all of the above. One of the first forms of class society, class division, was patriarchy. Because previous to this kind of division in society, which came after the enshrining of private property rights and the development of domesticated agriculture, we would have seen more matriarchal societies, where in fact women played the most important political, social, economic, and other roles. But because of the particular roles that non-women played, such as laborers, gatherers, farmers, military, etc., once society developed to a certain point, and once social practice had become kind of engendered into the society, the social practice of, you know, kind of breaking labor up into different divisions and certain sectors, you know, holding certain control over certain sectors. And depending on how society and history develops, one group might, in this case, the non-women who went on to own the tools, the land, the knowledge for farming, for the domestication of animals, military weaponry, and therein were able to write and enshrine a certain type of legal system that ultimately respected their own rights to property, their own rights to profit, and, you know, by kind of necessity, the rights to property and profit of those who also own private property. However, the issue is that the majority of society does not. And the goal of private property, in fact, although we're told it is competition, we have to think about what does competition normally lead to? It normally leads to a winner, right? And if we're talking about a capitalist system where the person who wins gets the contracts, gets to produce the goods, and makes the profit, that means there really is no second and third. Because the second and third are either, you know, kind of on a last limb, or, you know, in the process of, or already have been bought up by the monopoly, aka the winner, aka number one. So, kind of like in a classroom or in a sports event, there's always a winner. Competition leads to monopoly, especially in capitalism. So, once we develop this patriarchal system, once private property is enshrined in law, once historical social practices become more enshrined, you have a necessity now to shift over the way in which society had been producing and reproducing itself for a period of time. Again, previously, goods were cooperatively distributed somewhat equitably because of the general participation of all members or most members in society in different roles, but also because it would have made less sense at that point when it was necessary for survival, for everyone to be healthy, for everyone to be cooperating, for everyone to be able to do what they need to do and have what they need to have. Would have made way less sense to take advantage of anyone at this point, or to have, for example, like a massive army of unemployed people, because there was no way that a society at this stage of development would have been able to do anything other than dig mass graves, and that would have taken away from the labor and productivity of that society as a whole. So once this becomes more commonplace to, instead of producing things for the sake of use within society to make sure that everybody has what they need, now as class society develops, as private property develops, you have production no longer for the sake of use. So for example, you no longer grow crops or mine resources or, you know, shape an axe or a hammer or a sword for the sake of, like, using it, either yourself or within your own immediate society. You, in fact, began to produce these things, or were forced to stop producing these things, either go out of business and become a general manufacturer at some other business, or switch over what you were producing, no more for the sake of use, no more for the sake of the needs of society, no more for the sake of equitable distribution. Now, you are producing things for the sake of exchange, for the sake of profit. Once this takes place, and where it really starts to take place, is in the outskirts of different societies. For example, where a fishing culture and a hunting culture might interact, you might have two different types of production capabilities, many different types of commodities that the opposing society, whether you're looking at the fishing or the hunting society, the other society, respectively, would have other commodities, other cultural kind of tools, institutions, ideas, that would lead to an interest and exchange between cultures. This is one of the most human characteristics that we have, socialization. So once this socialization begins to take place between different societies, again, you have this interest in no longer producing things so that you can have whatever you need, because now if you want, you know, an ear of corn or fucking wood for your fire, you can't just expect to go somewhere and get it or to go out and cut it down yourself because you're busy doing something else. And the only places you can get it, you have to pay for it. And they're no longer willing to take, you know, exchanges or barters. Now they're expecting something called money. So once this kind of interaction begins to develop between civilizations, and once this production for the sake of exchange begins to happen on the outskirts, it also causes a reaction internally in the society, which then forces the majority, if not the whole of society, to begin producing similarly for the sake of exchange. Now, why does this matter? Well, in order to really understand it, we have to drop it back a little bit and ask ourselves, what is production and what is a commodity? So production for me, and this is not a technical definition, but production for me is the way in which society creates things that are necessary for its consumption. Now, again, this can range from a plethora of things. When we're talking about a commodity, the strict definition is an item that meets needs or wants of a human being, or of a human society. Now, in Capital Volume 1 Marx points out that this can be a physical or a mental need. Meaning, although we can understand that iPhones are not a physical need, when COVID hit, factories were producing iPhones instead of ventilators. Factories were producing, you know, all sorts of generic prescriptions and different drugs for over-the-counter usage or for, you know, side effects of other medication that you're taking, rather than producing medication or vaccines for COVID. Anyways, so it doesn't necessarily need to be something that you or I can look at and say, oh yeah, a human being needs this. It in fact is something that society at large, you know, usually on an individual level, says we need this. So, you know, what is produced in the domestic colonies known as the United States versus what is produced in China is ultimately decided not by, quote, markets. And actually, this probably isn't the best example because China's production system is different. So let's instead switch China out for Germany. What Germany and the United States produce are different, not because of some mystical, abstract, free hand that decides it all, but because the capitalists, the CEOs, the board of directors, and the actual production managers, the people who are reaping the profits off of accumulating commodities and then selling them for a profit, ultimately get to make a choice about whether or not they're willing to stop producing something cheaply that then they can mark up at a profit and rake in a very high percentage of profitability, rather than, you know, ceasing that production for the sake of producing that, you know, thing or those things that might not rake in a sizable amount of money, but are extremely necessary to society. Ultimately, individuals, bankers, etc., they get to decide these things. We don't. So when we say society, in a class society, we have to ask ourselves, who controls society? Again, it's the class that dictates and dominates over us. That is the ruling class, aka the capitalist class. And this group gets to determine that human beings are instead going to starve, die, eat poor and unhealthy foods, you know, be forced to work in labor extended periods of time to produce things that are ultimately useless in the grand scheme of things, just for the sake of selling cheap commodities for a marked up price. So now that we kind of have this down, when we talk about, you know, the reaction that comes to happen within society and how now things are no longer being produced for the sake of use, but they're instead being produced for the sake of exchange, the reason why this is a big problem is because now nobody has what they need. Nobody has what they need. The majority of people in society do not have what they need. And this can be societies which previously, you know, really showed the European world what cooperation and advancement can look like outside of a capitalist system. Many indigenous nations around the world who have been slaughtered, who live on concentration camps known as reservations, who are forced to leave these concentration camps and go concentrate in urban centers where they are some of the highest rates of incarcerated folks, of homicides, of victims of violence, whether that be physical, mental, sexual, etc. These societies previously, and still do in some places around the world, like in Bolivia, show us that there is a different way to live. There's a different way to advance. There's a different way to produce. There's a different way to relate to each other. And that's the second reason why the way in which we produce commodities, or what we produce commodities for, is ultimately important, is because the relationships that we have in our jobs, the relationships we have with people at the stores that we go into, the relationships that we have with people in general, are ultimately cultivated through a foundation of society's production. Now, I know this might seem odd or complex or just kind of a tautological statement that I'm just saying and I'm expecting you to just accept it. No, we're going to talk about it. The reason why society's mode of production ultimately reflects the other kind of areas of society is because in a capitalist society, what we know as the base, aka what really structures or, you know, stands as the base, the foundation to everything else in society, is the economic mode of production. How things are produced, who produces them, who accumulates those goods when they are produced. Do the producers own those goods, or does the capitalist? And who sells them? Who gets to decide what prices they are set at? Who buys them, etc. Because this is the reality, and because this, you know, kind of mode of production exists in all societies from the earliest civilizations to today, there has always needed to be some form of mode of production and reproduction, but there has not always needed to be these other, what we call, superstructural things, such as law, religion, politics, sociology, psychology. All of this really comes out of the formulation and development historically of how a given society produces things and consumes things, aka what it produces and who for, and B, how it reproduces itself. That's another big one. Because workers are really given no rights in a capitalist system, because a capitalist system requires workers to exploit, many capitalist systems around the world do not have or allow abortions. A lot of countries around the world do not have or allow serious institutions to develop to actually fix the familial and social problems that are endemic in the society, because ultimately this is what leads to a extreme poverty and extreme inequality and insecurity, which then allows the capitalist class to exploit people at such extreme levels. And the fact that so many people, billions in fact, are in this position around the world where the only way that they can survive is by selling their labor power, their ability to work, their mental faculties, their physical abilities, their sensations, etc. Selling this on a day-to-day basis to someone who gets to decide what they are going to pay, what they are going to make you work at, how long they are going to make you work, if they're going to give you things like insurance, if they're going to give you things like time off. A lot of these things, although there are laws in place, do still get to be decided on an individual case-to-case level, because the government and the institutions that exist to hold, you know, employers accountable to these laws, in fact, have stronger relations and interests with the capitalist class themselves than they do with the workers. Anyways, the last reason why this shift to commodity production under capitalism for the sake of exchange and for profit is so different and big is because commodities have existed throughout society for a very long time. Societies have been producing things for their needs and wants for a very long time. And now, all of a sudden, you have this development where that is no longer the case. And that is a huge, 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 huge historical phenomenon when you put it in that historical lens. So, as we finish up, the reason why I wanted to talk about this in order to expand on my episodes on capitalist exploitation and on imperialism is because ultimately this engenders a certain type of exploitative, always growing, always seeking out cheaper resources, larger markets, cheaper labor forces, system that cannot stop in its own kind of formulas, with its own internal mechanisms. Capitalism cannot fix itself. Capitalism cannot reform itself. And this is why, ultimately, I think understanding really what capitalism is, how things are produced and reproduced within a capitalist society, what is exploitation, where it happens, how it happens, and understanding therein how this system, capitalism, at a certain level of advanced development, leads to a full conquest of the world, a full colonialism, full colonization of the world. And eventually, once it hits that point, and you have competing capitalist powers around the world, you're going to have what we call a reconquest, or a recolonization of the world. So now, places like Africa, Latin America, and Asia, which for some decades, in some cases hundreds of years, have been ruled or dictated over by this or that European power, now have to go through a period where the European powers, or the European powers and the North American powers, are now engaging in inter-imperialist war, or simply just warfare in general, for the sake of attaining the ownership and dictatorship over this or that region. We see this in Ukraine today. We've seen this in the Congo. We've seen this in Cuba. We've seen this in Venezuela. We've seen this in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in India. We've seen this all over the world. Imperialism, however, is not simply a militaristic system. And this is why understanding commodity production and also understanding capitalism is important. Because it helps us to understand how imperialism, in fact, really has more to do with the banks. It has more to do with NGOs. It has more to do with counter-revolutionary groups, or pro-capitalist groups, or civil society groups who, you know, previously had a history of revolutionary ideology, a revolutionary struggle, and in fact, trying to push those groups and others who are coming up into the struggle now towards either a more liberal or conservative view of this struggle for the sake of bringing people back into the system, bringing people back into a capitalist ideology, and breaking them away from this idea of revolution. Revolution against imperialism is not simple, because unlike what we might think about China or Russia, Russia and China are not militarily exploiting, oppressing or occupying the sizable, massive amounts of land that the 800 plus documented military bases that the United States has, plus its other firms, corporations, farming plants, factories, etc. around the world. China nor Russia sets deals, debts, or trade with foreign nations for the sake of unequal exchange. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't unequal exchange, but the purpose of these nations, similarly to nations like Iran, right, do not have as a stated goal mass profit off of the backs of the exploited masses of workers around the world. This much is clear in the type of actions that these countries have taken, being counterposed to the type of actions that European powers and North American powers have made in the same or similar contexts. So now, as we wrap up on this point, we must say that ultimately, revolution is necessary because imperialism, at a certain stage of advanced capitalist development, encompasses the whole of society. It encompasses every single bit, every single corner, every single idea, every single institution of the capitalist system. You can no longer speak of revolutionary institutions that might have some relevance or prevalence within capitalist society. All of these have been co-opted, shut down, or targeted and, incarcerated, assassinated, or exiled. The, you know, spaces in the universities or in civil society or in NGOs and nonprofits where it was easy or easier to speak about revolutionary ideas, to talk about the need for revolution, this has been completely skewed. it's not necessarily the same as the period of, you know, kind of the turn of the 19th century, or 1900s, I should say, where, you know, McCarthyism and anti-immigration and mass deportation were at the height that they were at. Although, while saying that, I should also, you know, check myself, because it is very true that anti-communism and, you know, things like this label of domestic terrorist, right, are being used to paint groups like the African People's Socialist Party as terrorists, as foreign national, you know, actors who are being lied to or misinformed by the Russian state government / military. And you also have at this period of time a sizable influx of reaction and of police presence in communities or in places where previously revolutionary ideas would have kind of won out, even in left sort of spaces or in oppressed communities. The reactionary state, the reactionary state ideologies, liberalism, conservatism, all are gaining some kind of traction that in another point in time, we on the left could have very easily taken apart, but we do not have the level of organization and education that the left once did, even in their unsuccessful attempts to create such a movement and organization here in the West. We still are behind even that. So, the last thing I want to say is just, I know this wasn't very introductory. I ended up having a lot more to say than I wanted. But I hope that this is useful, not for the sake of being like, oh, I know better, so like, this episode isn't for me, or I already know these things, so I don't need to listen, or, you know, that's not what imperialism is. Like, if you listen to this episode, cool, and, you know, if you get something out of it, extra cool, but you have to understand that this is shit that I've read and come to learn and come to understand myself. You don't have to agree with me, and I don't really care if you do. My goal here is to learn. So if you disagree, don't give me bullshit and don't just stop listening. Or if you think you already know this stuff, don't stop listening. Keep learning. Keep growing. Reach out. If you genuinely disagree with anything that I ever say, I hope that it's clear that I'm literally a person who just reads this shit. I'm not a scholar. I'm not like a revolutionary, really, in any sense, in the case of, like, my actions don't speak as loud as my words, unfortunately. And also, you know, I'm someone who's been very clear that I am actively learning, that I am open to learning from folks. So, reach out. Contact me. But what I really want to say is just that, ultimately, it is up to us to make this change, right? This is going to be a little speechy and ranty, so I'm going to hit the bowl for this, but we have to really consider the fact that these organizations, these collectives, these spaces that exist are only as good, not as their word, but as their deed. If the material conditions aren't changing because of the type of organizing that is happening, you have to ask yourself two things. One, are we putting the cart before the horse and expecting big change when it's not practical to expect? Or B, are we just plainly not organizing properly for the situation? Because there's certain instances where you can be doing everything right, like in a union case, right? And it's just a grind, right? In tenant organizing, it's just a grind. And so you can do a lot of things right, you can struggle really hard, and still not see a whole lot of feasible gains outside of like relationships and building consciousness among yourselves. But then there's other things where, like, you know, stuff happens. Like, we have rallies in the United States and around the world where thousands of people turn out. and nothing feasibly changes. So we have to ask ourselves, do the certain tactics that we're using always meet the criteria of the moment at hand? And I think that we know the answer to this question. And I think many people more smarter and more real than me are making the serious critique that the left, really, of the world, has a lot on their table and isn't taking it very seriously, especially in the West. Now, I can't say the same for the Global South. There are very strong civil society movements, political movements, land back movements, indigenous movements, anti-police movements, anti-capitalist movements, communist parties, etc. But at the same time, many of these groups, right, don't always live up to their name, especially the communist parties. So the only thing that we can really critique and the only thing that we can really change is our own actions, our own attitude, and our own willingness to do more. If we're not willing to change any of these things, nothing, I repeat, nothing will change in our lives. Not our situation, not our personality, not our maturity, not our ability to organize, not our ability to make friends. If you want to see the world change, you have to ask yourselves, how have those in the Caribbean, in Latin America, in Africa, and in Asia organized themselves against colonialism and succeeded in the varying degrees in which they have succeeded? How have these very same people built some of the strongest trade union movements, some of the strongest women's federations and movements, some of the strongest political parties, and also some of the strongest communist parties? Look at Swaziland. Look at Kenya. Look at Venezuela. Look at Cuba. Look at Vietnam. Look at China. These are nations which have done the things which we talk about wanting to do, and yet we do not study them. Not only do we not study them, we put our ideals, our purity fetishes, and our absolute ignorance of the reality in front of us ahead of the real lived experiences of revolutionaries who would put us in our goddamn chairs if we ever even so much as made an attempt to have a conversation with them. But instead, we look at this or that country or this or that movement or this or that party, and we just label down a list all of our criticisms with no real consciousness of the fact that we have built nothing of the sort here in the West. The Communist Party USA does not fucking hold a light to the July 26th movement. The different organizations which have really, really stood up strong, I'm thinking here of the BPP, of the Black Liberation Army, right? We're not able to have their revolution. This does not mean the work that they did doesn't matter, that their organizational strategies were failed. But it is to say that, unfortunately, they were not able to grant the ability to the people to directly participate in the construction of society because they were not able to seize power over the means of production in the government from the largest militaristic and imperialist power in the world. Go figure. And that is mostly because these organizations were left to die, were left to be incarcerated, were left to flee, because the socialists and communists of the West refused to stand with African people. They refused to stand with Latin Americans. They have refused to stand time and time again with the true revolutionaries around the world because of their European fanaticism and because of their ignorance, which comes from an absolute lack of real lived revolutionary experience and relationships with revolutionaries. If you want to see the material world around you change, you have to ask yourself what you've been doing to make it change. And if that would make anything change in any other field or any other practice or any other sector of your life, if you want to lose weight, if you want to get a job, if you want to change your personality, if you want to change your style, if you want to go out and get a partner, if you want to learn a skill, if you want to build stronger relationships, ask yourself what you would do in that situation that you're not doing now. What would you do in those situations that revolutionaries and revolutionary parties have done in the past, and why you're not doing it now? If it's because you're scared, if it's because you're anxious, if it's because you're confused, that's fine. Nobody's shitting on you. Nobody's upset with you. Unless you are ignorantly and intentionally avoiding, critiquing, and correcting the mistakes that you are making and that your organizations are making, then nobody is here to beat you upside the head with a stick. And that's why, really, honestly, all of us, every single one of us, need to really stop playing the social media game the way we've been playing it. Need to stop playing the organizing the way we've been playing it. Need to stop being so dogmatic. Need to be, stop being so overtly critical of others while being absolutely uncritical of ourselves. And especially, we have to learn from and build relationships with those who have real lived experiences in making revolution. Because reforms and repairs will not bring an equitable or meaningful or equal society to the majority of people around the world. The only thing that can do that is revolution and socialism. So lastly, my friends, I say long live the people, all power to the people, long live revolution, and all power to the revolutionary peoples, parties, movements, organizations, and collectives, historically speaking, presently, and to come in the future. Let us remember, if nothing exists today that meets the criteria for revolution, then we must build it so that tomorrow we do not have to take step one again. Peace.